You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Tonight we talk to Steve Binder, a veteran of television who is responsible for some of the greatest broadcasts in the history of the medium, including the famous Elvis Presley comeback special. Steve Binder has also written a book with Mary Beth Liebman about variety television called Fade Up 26, The Movers and Shakers of Variety Television. Steve Binder, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, appreciate it.
First, let me ask you, what does the producer of variety show do exactly? And along with that, like, who's the boss? I mean, if you're producing Lucy in London, are you the boss or is Lucy the boss?
That's a great question. The truth of the matter is I'm primarily a director, and I realized in television I would get that question all the time. What's the definition of a producer? It reached the point where even the Producers Guild was trying to define job definition. And the truth of the matter is when you walk on a stage, there's always a dynamic. In television, it's really more a star and a producer's medium rather than a director's. So I felt as a director, in order to have more control over my projects and not have somebody leaning over my shoulder saying, I want you to take this shot or tell the artist they should do such and such, I decided to become a hyphenate and become a producer and a director. And most of my shows and specials and what have you, I've held that, even though I've hired very, very competent nuts and bolts producers who worry about the budget, worry about the facilities being there on time, and so forth. So it's really a case, if you're starting out and you walk on a stage and you're working with a major talent, such as a Lucille Ball, there's a dynamic. They want to know, can you stand up to them? Can you play their Jiminy Cricket sitting on their shoulder, giving them your honest feelings about what they're doing? Because all artists are depending upon their director to tell them whether they're doing, in every take, whether they're doing the right job or they could improve on certain aspects of their acting or their singing or whatever. And they're looking to the director mostly for giving them that kind of direction. So it really is a case of where I've met producers all my career that come from all different walks of life. I mean, there are some fantastic creative producers, and a lot of them come from the writing field where they create the material, the script that you're going to work with, and they become the producer hyphenate writer. And then there are producers who just have relationship with the star of the show, and they take the title producer as well. And then there's a catch-all where they can't find justification for credits at the end of the shows. They end up giving people producer credits who have no more talent or responsibility in the producing of a project than the man in the moon. It could be the artist's best friend or their hairdresser or their, the person who, in a sense, has a connection where the artist is so powerful that they say, I want so-and-so on the show and make them a producer. So the Producers Guild has done a great job in the last decade of trying to hone down who does the work, and that's what it really boils to. Who's there first thing in the morning on the set? Who leaves as the last person? And so it really is a case in my career, I know what a director does. I've had to work on what's my job as the producer. And it's kind of like if you'd compare it to a pilot of a 747. I mean, the pilot is the person flying the airplane. That's the person you depend on to get you up in the air and down on the ground safely.
Now, today we refer to the showrunner. Is that what you were?
showrunners are more the writers, producers of shows. And unless you control the show, I mean, you asked me earlier, you know, when I did the Lucille Ball special, as a matter of fact, who's the boss? Well, hopefully in any situation, you all have something to bring to the party. So naturally, the person with the most power is probably the person with the most credits and the most famous.
Right.
And when they walk on a stage, that's a challenge to a director, a writer, even a producer, in terms of how do they challenge the person who is the star, who has all this visibility, acceptability, power of just their prestige and their name, and they're the one in front of the camera. So rightfully so, they're always concerned about being protected. If they have respect for you as a director, or respect for you as a producer, or respect for you as a writer, there aren't any lines in terms of who's the boss. It becomes a team, and I'm a great believer in, as a producer-director, putting together the most talented people I can find in all the other areas of a production, all the other departments, and they'll make you look great. And unfortunately, in the entertainment industry, you know, who does the public and the industry itself look to as the people with the biggest salaries, the biggest names, and so forth? They look to the star first, obviously, and the producer and the director second and third. And I wouldn't even define second and third. I find those equal. So when I started out in my early 20s directing, and I'd walk on a stage, I was even one time I walked on a stage, I think it was directing a Gilligan's Island early on, and some old stagehand came by and say, "Hey, kid, this is a restricted stage. Get off the stage," not realizing I was the director of the show. And I always was amused by that, and had the philosophy that on my stages, everybody's welcome. You know, I mean, as long as they know who's calling the shots and who makes the final decisions. But with all the talent I've worked with over the years, and I can name a lot of, you know, major stars, the great thing about it, I never, ever, intentionally anyway, put anybody on a pedestal and say they're better or than anybody else. In other words, we're all working for the same purpose, and that's to make the show and the star come off as great as possible. And it has to be a team effort to do it. I've had the philosophy as a director that if I listen to everybody's quote-unquote advice, and everybody has advice to give, a director or the star probably, it's really a case of, as long as everybody knows, you make the final decision. You as the director make the decision whether the whole team is going to go to the right or the whole team is going to go to the left. Where you have chaos on a set is when you've got half the people trying to save the other half of the people, and therefore they're split in terms of some people are doing one thing while other people are doing another thing, and then it's chaos. So I've always had the philosophy, especially as directing my shows, if I make a mistake and everybody makes the exact same mistake, somehow it magically turns out okay. It's only when everybody is not sure where we're going, what the direction is, that it turns out to be very, very chaotic.
We're talking with Steve Binder. He's a veteran of television, and he's just written this great book. It's called Fade Up, The 26 Movers and Shakers of Variety Television, and there's interviews with tons of great television names. You may not know the names, as Tommy Smothers says in the introduction of the book, but you'll know all the shows that they produced very well. And I'm so happy that he wrote the book, because it's brought him to From the Bookshelf, and now I get to talk to him about all these great things that he's done in his career. Let's go back for just a second to Lucy in London. What was it like to work with Lucy? Did she take direction well? You know, she was kind of after I Love Lucy, kind of after, kind of midway through the Lucy show at that point, right?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, when I got the call from Lucy, I was kind of shocked, to be honest with you. I mean, she's was the biggest female star probably in the world at the time. And she was the head of one of the major studios in Hollywood, Desilu Productions, that she started with her former husband, Desi Arnaz. And it was a case of when she did call me and said she was coming up for a vacation, was planning on possibly going to London, and would I be interested in working with her, and she'd give up her vacation if we could do a television musical special. And I said, Lucy, why call me? Because you've got this incredible team doing, at the time she was doing the Lucy show as Lucy Carmichael, her character name. And I said, why would you want to switch gears when you've got this well-oiled machine that week after week churns out, you know, within the top five, you know, top shows in the United States, let alone in syndication around the world? And she said, because I want to do something really different, Steve, and I've been watching your work going back to, you know, when I started doing specials with Petula Clark and Harry Belafonte and Elvis Presley, and she said, I want to do something that's different than the Lucy show. And CBS had made the decision that they would preempt one of the regular time slots of the Lucy show if she did this musical special. The setup basically is on her own show, Lucy Carmichael wins a free trip to England with her tour guide, Anthony Newley. And they set up her just winning the trip, and then they opened up the following week an hour of prime time for me to work with her and do this musical special called Lucy in London, which incidentally is on the fifth season DVD of the Sony Lucy series of her show. And they actually, Sony actually did a fantastic documentary, and on Lucy's fifth season, on the second disc, the entire disc is devoted to this documentary on the making of Lucy in London, and then the actual showing of the Lucy in London special. So I'm really pleased, and I will say, to answer your question, she was not only fun to work with, she was a delight, because Lucy loved to rehearse, and that's something that's I won't say a rarity in television, but a lot of actors really don't want to put the effort or the time in to keep rehearsing the scene until they feel they've really honed in to, you know, the essence of what they're trying to accomplish in a scene. And you know, with Lucy, it was totally the opposite. How many times can I rehearse and run through the scene before we shoot it? So she was a total professional, and we had a lot of fun in our conversations. I had the good fortune of every day the car would pick us up. They'd first pick Lucy up, who was staying at the Hilton Hotel in London, and then they'd pick myself up. And so the two of us sat in the back seat of the car while we drove maybe sometimes 30, 40 minutes to locations. So I got to know her really, really well at the time, and you know, it was a great experience. Unfortunately, there was a lot of criticism of Lucy not sticking with her character that was so well defined. That we did a stunt, for instance, where she wins the trip with Anthony Newley. He's the tour guide. She thinks she's going to be driven around London in a limousine. It turns out he has a motorcycle and a sidecar. And he says, this is going to be a lot more fun, Lucy. And instead of going to all the cliche tourist places, we're going to places that I want to show you that are a lot more fun. Like, instead of going to 10 Downing Street, which is the home of the Prime Minister, we're going to number 12 Downing Street, which is, you know, some kind of a club or somewhere where we're going to have an adventure that most tourists never get to go to or see. So the premise was really, really well thought out, even though it was a last-minute decision on her part to actually do it. I was in New York directing a Jack Parr special at the time called A Funny Thing Happened at the White House, a political special. And so I just jumped on an airplane, went and met her in London, and we just took off I think we shot almost for a month every day on location, and we're writing the script as we went along from day to day. We didn't anticipate that every single day in London it rained. We kind of improvised that in the script as we went along. She did a very funny sketch on the Thames River where she and Tony Newley are in a life raft, and they get hit by the crew of a racing crew of college athletes, they sink into the Thames River. So she was a real, try anything daredevil kind of artist, which I loved. In fact, on that specific scene, we were told, make sure Lucy doesn't fall into the Thames because it's really polluted. It's not safe to be in the water. I guess what went on in the Olympics right now in Brazil and so forth. But Lucy said, "Well, it's not going to be funny if I don't fall in the water." And so she went in with Newley when the shell actually crashed into the raft.
Wow! So she really had her comic instincts.
Yeah, and she was willing to try anything. I mean, there were no. There wasn't any hesitation at let's try this, let's do this, or whatever. We had one incident. I think it was Wilfred Hyde White or a very famous English character actor in a scene, and they were down in the House of Wax, which is very famous in London, and she strays away from the tour group, and the next thing you know, she's in the torture chamber in the wax museum, and she thinks she's going to be the victim of torture, and as a result takes a wine bottle and hits the tour guide over the head to escape. And unfortunately, the prop department did not have a wax wine bottle which was ordered for the scene, and it was a real wine bottle. And she hit this actor, she actually, it's not something I would laugh at normally and certainly didn't at the time, but she actually made him bleed when she hit the wine bottle on his skull.
Oh, my God.
And we had to rush him to the emergency hospital and get him patched up and so forth. Fortunately, it wasn't that serious, but it was certainly a shock to all of us.
Can we see that? I mean, when we watch the show, is that scene in the show?
Yeah, that scene is actually in the show. And, but in all of the productions of everything I've done, there's always been something unexpected to happen. No matter how well you plan your production, you can rest assured it's going to turn out, in most cases, better than what you had ever planned. When I did Diana Ross in Central Park during that huge rainstorm, what would have been another concert like Barbra Streisand and Simon and Garfunkel turned out to be an international news story because of the heavy rainfall in Central Park at the time. So things sometimes turn out to even be better than you possibly could have imagined.
Yeah, we're talking with Steve Bender, and rock and roll fans would be particularly interested in him because among all the things that he's directed and produced for television are some classic rock and roll things, including that Diana Ross special. You know, the what happened with that special was, if I remember correctly, it was on Showtime and it was broadcast live. And in the middle, as soon as it started raining, and the storm just got worse and worse and worse. And it was actually one of the sexiest things ever seen on television when Diana Ross was drenched.
Well, as one local reporter in New York said, the show was lit by God, because when the rain hit, all of the audio equipment went out, shorted out. We're lucky nobody got electrocuted, but fortunately for us, one huge 10-kilowatt light out in the Central Park field stayed lit, and it was magical to see it on her during this incredible rainstorm, which you could see on camera. Normally, when you're trying to show rain in film or on television, what they do so it'll stand out is mix it with milk. And in this particular case, the rain was so thick and heavy and real that you could see the rain. There's some shots in there that are just spectacular of her being drenched. We didn't need anything to augment so that the audience at home or watching it on the screen, and there's a wonderful, wonderful DVD put out by the Shout Factory that you can purchase that has not only the actual concert that we did the following day, but it has the entire Rainstorm section in it. To me, that is the magic and, you know, the part of the special that I loved. I love when you're planning something and then all of a sudden you have to go off script and kind of figure out how to improvise on the spot and get it done. And as a matter of fact, I had blocked the entire Diana Ross in Central Park show. When the Rainstorm hit, I looked at my technical director and said, let's just close our script books and let's just wing it. We know where the cameras are and what the shots should be. And I was fortunate that year to win the Directing Ace Award, which was comparable to winning an Emmy. This before the Academy and the cable industry got together with commercial television and cable television at the same time to award Emmy Awards and so forth. But it was an exciting, exciting experience. And that was, you know, one of many. I mean, I go back early in my career where I had the good fortune to do a feature film called The Tammy Show, T-A-M-I, which was basically just an accident of good timing, coincidence, etc. But it, out of the nine or so artists that appeared in the Tammy movie, the Rolling Stones, James Brown and the Flames, the
Beach Boys, Jim,
Marvin Gaye, the Supremes,
Leslie Gore,
Chuck Berry, it just goes on and on. But who would have thought in 1964 when I actually directed that practically all of them, I think minus one or two, are today actually inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I mean, that was just unbelievable good timing and great insight in terms of you know, the casting of putting all those artists on stage at the same time. So I had the opportunity to film all of them. It's considered one of the top concert films probably ever made. It certainly, historically, it's in the Library of Congress, as a matter of fact. It never fails, no matter what decade or what age, it never fails to excite an audience. I mean, it just, the James Brown and Mick Jagger and the Rolling Stones segments alone make the event so special. And everybody on there, you know, it wasn't just phoning it in. They were there the entire time I filmed it, rooting the other artists on. It was almost like an Olympic event where you see this team spirit, and that was the way this cast, they were all there, nobody left. They all watched each other do their performances. They all subtly and probably subconsciously tried to do their best work so they wouldn't embarrass themselves, because there were so many great performances in that film.
And you staged that at the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium.
Yeah, exactly. And it was the beginning, I don't know if you remember or know the name of the Wrecking Crew, which were the great studio musicians in California.
They're all in the film.
Yeah, and they were the house orchestra for us under the direction of Jack Nitzsche. At the time, Jack Nitzsche and Phil Spector were the two biggest West Coast record producers in the industry. And Jack had gone on after the Tammy Show to score so many great films like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and so forth.
So you must have met Diana Ross then when you were doing that, or had you already met her?
I had worked with Diana on the Tammy Show and then continued to work for her and with her to this day. We've done about six or seven major primetime specials for many of the networks, and certainly for HBO. We went to Wembley Stadium together and did an HBO special. But every time I work with Diana, it's special. She puts 110% into everything she does, and it's a joy to work with her. And I've had the privilege to be asked back so many times, and every time, you know, something happens that's magical. I mean, she just, you know, she's so encouraging. And she gives you the feeling, if you're on her crew, she gives you the feeling that you have to be one of the best in the industry or you wouldn't be working with her, you know. And that gives you great confidence when you know how supportive the artist or the star is in terms of working with the people that they work with.
So you've been working with her for 50 years, which is kind of incredible.
Exactly.
This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro. Tonight we're talking with Steve Binder, a veteran of television who's responsible for some of the greatest broadcasts in the history of the medium. We're talking with Steve Binder, and he's just written this great book about television, and it's called Fade Up, 26 The Movers and Shakers of Variety Television. But we have to talk about Singer Presents Elvis. Elvis kind of had been going through the 1960s making a lot of movies that were, some of them were better than others, but on the whole, they were pretty bad. And he finally sort of turned his back on those bad movies and came back, and that's why it's called the Comeback Special, with a television special that was aired in December of 1968, I believe.
Yeah, it was 1968. I had just completed a Petula Clark Harry Belafonte special where it broke the color line in primetime variety special.
They
where
held hands, I believe.
Petula reached over and touched Harry on the forearm, and that became an international incident that was actually in Time magazine and Newsweek magazine, who covered the story. And it was interesting because I think I would have never got the call to do the Elvis Presley special if it weren't for the preceding special earlier in that year. And it's because it caught the attention of NBC. Colonel Parker just made a deal with NBC that NBC would finance Elvis's next movie, but only on the condition that he do this television special, which the Colonel wanted Elvis to sing 20 Christmas songs, and that was it, without talking. And I had no intention of doing that from day one. But it was, it led to this amazing relationship. Elvis actually, I think, was the only time in his career where he really left his environment, his own entourage, his Graceland, and joined our team. There was only one person that he asked to be a part of our family that I had accumulated since working on Hullabaloo and Leslie Uggams special and Petula and Harry Belafonte, and then and that was Billy Strange, who had worked with him on his on some of his records. But Billy, when we started, was very involved. Nancy Sinatra had a huge hit record called These Boots Are Made for Walking. So Billy became unavailable to do the Presley special, and then I went to, you know, my guy who I'd worked with on all of the shows I mentioned, going back to Hullabaloo, was Billy Goldenberg, who really changed Elvis's musical direction. And it's the first time Elvis sang with a large orchestra. Up until that point, he'd only worked with a rhythm section, and then they would always add instruments after he was gone. So this was, you know, an amazing experience, because there have been so many books written about it, and certainly became the signature visual signature and the kind of historic landmark for all of the Elvis world of merchandising and photographs and what have you is kind of built around that comeback special. And it turned out to be where I started out, not even being a West Coast guy. I wasn't really into Elvis Presley at the time. And by the time I started working with him and we finished, I was a diehard Elvis fan, realized why he was, without it being in his contract, he was the real king of rock and roll. You know, even a Michael Jackson and the king of pop, it was in Michael's contract that every time he performed, the announcer had to announce that to the audience participating and watching. In Elvis's case, I think he proved beyond a shadow of a doubt why he was so special. And I think, for me, the beauty of that special was watching a man kind of rediscover himself. Because when I met Elvis, I don't think he was really too confident about his own talents, thinking that maybe this was because he was with such powerful public relations and promotion people like RCA Records and Colonel Parker's machine and so forth, that until the 68 special, where he really had a chance to be himself, and it was great for me to realize, you know, it was that Sally Field moment on the Academy Awards where she looks out at her peers and says, "You love me, you really love me." And I think Elvis said, "Hey, it wasn't Colonel Parker, it wasn't RCA, it wasn't the hype and so forth. You know, people really love me for my talent." And he certainly had more than enough to prove it. I mean, there's only a few icons in the world that generation after generation are remembered, and Elvis certainly is at the top of the heap. I mean, I'm amazed that, you know, people my age who are now the grandparents have brought along, you know, their children and their children's children and their grandchildren and everything who've become worldwide Elvis fans, and his legend lives on from day to day.
You staged that show in Burbank in front of an audience?
We shot it all in on, I think it was stage 4 at NBC Burbank. And, you know, the great part of that show became the acoustic improvisation section, which frankly, you know, was something that was not in the original game plan for the show. We were not doing a Christmas special per se, but we had huge production numbers with a gospel segment. We had a guitar man segment where he jumps from scene to scene on his way to fame and fortune. We had a lot of major production segments, but Elvis lived at NBC while I shot the special. We cleared out one of the large dressing rooms next to the stage. We put a bed in there, and it was for that reason that Elvis, when he finished rehearsing or he finished shooting anything, would go into his dressing room, bedroom, and he'd jam until 3, 4 in the morning with whoever happened to be hanging out. And that's what gave me the idea, I need to get this on film and put it into the show, because I'd never seen anything like it where he was, you know, it showed everything that made him the superstar that he became. You know, it showed his great sense of humor, which he definitely had on and off camera, and, you know, and his great talent. You know, Elvis kind of underplayed the fact that he was a great guitarist, and yet other musicians that he played with all acknowledged that Elvis was very humble in downplaying his guitar playing. And in the 68 comeback special, especially in the improv sections and so forth, I mean, it was mesmerizing just to watch him. And, you know, at some point in the improv, I think he forgot all about there were cameras shooting him. This was a NBC television special. There was a guy, you know, directing the show and a whole, you know, staff around him and so forth. And he was just oblivious to all the technical stuff and just was having a ball. And I think that we were able to capture.
You re-edited that segment into another special called One Night With You, right?
Yeah, well, HBO picked it up, and all they wanted were the outtakes, but the outtakes turned out to be unedited, and I think to this day one of the highest-rated shows in HBO history, called One Night With You.
Yeah, and you had assembled some of Elvis's original collaborators, including the great guitarist, late great guitarist, Scotty Moore.
Yeah, when Elvis heard we were going to do the recreation, the Colonel wouldn't let me go into the dressing room with cameras, so he did give me permission eventually to recreate it on stage. And when Elvis heard that I was going to do that, he asked me if I would bring in DJ Fontana, his original drummer, and Scotty Moore, his original guitarist, which I did. And they created the magic in those segments as well, because he was home. I mean, he was with his original guys that he was totally comfortable with. And, you know, we had a few of his other entourage kind of guys within the set itself. Lance Legault, who was his movie stand-in, was there handing him various guitars that he wanted and playing the tambourine, not on stage, but down below it. We had his army buddy, when he was in the army in Germany, with him, and it just became kind of a loose family. We didn't even know if it was going to go into the special. In fact, the Colonel, when he said, "You can recreate it on stage, but I won't guarantee you could even put it in the show," well, that turned out to be the show. That was the real magic, and the minute I shot it, I said, hey, this is better than the, all the money we're spending on the dancers, singers, cast, and so forth. I mean, I've got to get this into the show. And fortunately, I was able to, especially when they aired the 90-minute version as opposed to the original first time aired. I think it was about a 48-minute version with commercial interruptions and so forth. Yeah. So I think from that standpoint, you know, all the specials that I did, especially in my early career, I never thought they would be on DVD. DVDs weren't even invented. I didn't think they would be on VHSs or restored. I thought they were just going to play live on the network one time, and that would be the end of it. So I'm thrilled that so many of my shows have made it to DVD, and they're really pristine in their visual and audio quality. So I couldn't be happier from that end.
It's pretty great for me to be able to watch all those things, including, gosh, the Edie Adams show and some of the other crazy things you've done in your career.
Yeah, I mean, it is amazing how everything old is new again, and it seems to have an audience.
This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro. Tonight we're talking with Steve Binder, a veteran of television who's responsible for some of the greatest broadcasts in the history of the medium.
I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to co-write Fade Up, 26 The Movers and Shakers, is because from day one in my career, I always wanted to teach. And I come from a family of teachers. And so I was an adjunct professor at USC for over 25, 30 years. And there never was a textbook that I really could bring into class and say, this is great for students and so forth. So when I met Mary Beth Liedman, who is an active professor to this day at Indiana University of Pennsylvania, and she came to me, she was in a group of teachers. I was hosting a seminar at the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. She was one of the teachers flown in. There were about 25 or 30 of them, which the Academy does every year to bring them to Hollywood so they can go back into their state and kind of have an updated version of what's going on in the heartbeat of the variety industry. And so it was a case of she came to me after the lecture, and I had three Emmy-winning directors on my panel. And, you know, she said, we should stay in touch. And so we did. And she said, I know this academic book publisher, Kendall Hunt, and they're interested in us doing a book. And I said, what kind of book will we do? And she said, you know, do I have any ideas? Maybe we should do the history of the Emmy Awards in Variety and so forth. And I kind of researched that and wasn't too enthusiastic about that. And I said, you know, what we're really lacking is the history of variety television, because we've been kind of the stepchild of the industry in general. Variety has become kind of a catch-all name for any other genre that you can't that you can't define. We know what drama is. We know what documentaries are. We know what reality shows are, et cetera. But if you said to somebody, define variety television, they say anything that you can't define in another category, another genre. And when I was teaching, my textbook was probably not even an industry type textbook. It was Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People, which I read at a very early age and felt, boy, that relates to the entertainment industry as well. You know, it is a people business, like most businesses. And then when this opportunity came to say, okay, let's do the history of variety television, how do we do it? And I said, let's do it from the people who are still dominating and living the variety genre of primetime specials, events, you know. And I contacted 25 of my peers. All of them accepted. And there are some names in there. And Tommy Smothers really nailed it. He did the foreword of the book, as you mentioned. And he said, if you may not be familiar with the names, you'll know all the shows these guys did. Contemporary, from Peter Pan on NBC, and to going back to Tony Sharmley, who's in his 90s, who was the original director when they started television after World War II, and he did the test patterns for two of the networks, and then he became a very famous choreographer. He was my choreographer on the Danny Kaye series. But he also was a very, very good director, and he directed all the Mitzi Gaynor early shows that were really fantastic variety series. And then we had Don Mischer, who I think is the most awarded Emmy-winning producer-director in the industry, who you've seen his name on zillions of credits, from Kennedy Center Honors to Emmys, just all these major, major special events. And right now, all of the shows are basically represented, the Oscars, the Emmys, the Grammys, and in many of the 25, I guess I should include myself, I am the 26th, but we've all taken shots at producing and directing the National Emmys. You know, many have done the Kennedy Center Honors, many have done, you know, the Grammys. Although Ken Ehrlich, who is featured in the book as well, has been with the Grammy Awards show as their key producer for now, you know, a couple of decades. And so it's been very, very exciting. I mean, we have everybody from George Schlatter, who created Laugh-In, to Walter Miller, who directed the Grammy show for years, is still one of the major producers, along with Ken Ehrlich. We have Nigel Lithgow, who does these great, he's English, and he does these great dance shows on television in America. Matthew Diamond, who does great performances for PBS, and Matthew did Peter Pan, which was live on television. It just goes on and on. Lou Horvitz, who has won so many awards for his Oscar direction and so many specials, and Kennedy Center Honors again. I only wish I had this book in my classroom for all those years that I taught. And you know, we through Mary Beth Liebman, we put the book out as an academic book for colleges and universities, and the publisher, which is very entrenched in academia, got so excited about it, they said, let's put out a second edition for the general public. Of anybody who watches television or loves television is going to love the stories we all tell. It was like, I don't know if you remember a movie called Rashomon, which was probably in the early 60s, a Japanese murder mystery, and they have three witnesses who all saw it, and they say it or tell their story from different points of view. Well, I knew everybody in the book for, you know, my entire career, but they were my friends. I didn't know what they did on their stages. I was too busy doing my own shows. So this book became, I was fascinated with hearing how they got into the industry, what went on behind the scenes on their productions and so forth. I never saw them direct anybody or be on stage. And now I have so much more respect for all of them. You know, it's just amazing. So I'm very, very excited about Fade Up and so thankful for Kendall Hunt for putting this book out for the general public.
Well, I'm glad you did. It is a really wonderful book and an insight into, you know, the Rashomon version of television, a real insight into the production and the history of American television.
You know, I have great, great respect for anybody who's in the business and, you know, who really puts the time and effort in. I mean, I've been in the business so long now, I've seen so many people come and go, and certainly so many people who, they wanted the glory, but they didn't want to put the effort into it, and they sort of came and went, where other people, like I've just described, have been in the business for their entire adult life, and like myself, and love it. I mean, I can't wait to get up in the morning to go to work to do what I do and love. Most people get jobs and then they can't wait to get off their job so they can go have fun and go play. My playing was I couldn't wait to wake up in the morning and get back to the stage to do what I love doing. And that feeling has never left me. Even when I worked as the executive producer of Pee-wee's Playhouse for 2 years, and I was working with both professional crew and amateur crew. And it was, you know, it's always been a learning experience for me, always.
Well, it's wonderful that you wrote this book. It's called Fade Up 26, The Movers and Shakers of Variety Television. And Steve Binder, thanks so much for reminiscing with us, and maybe you could come back and we can talk more about Soupy Sales.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at FromTheBookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Steve Binder. His new book, co-written with Mary Beth Liedman, is called Fade Up 26, The Movers and Shakers of Variety Television. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.